Today is Wednesday. It's March 15th, 2017. By the way, it's about 10:30 a.m. I'm John Williams, and I think we should continue to mention not only the date of this podcast, but also the time, because things move so quickly. Sometimes you record a podcast at 10:30 in the morning, and then people say, hey, why didn't you mention that thing? Because it happened 5 minutes later. That's the world we are living in these days. So, John Williams, you're listening to Playing Politics, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WCCO Radio. If you're not listening to this on our Facebook page, we post it at WCCO Radio's Facebook page each week. You can also hear this at the Star Tribune's website. Go to startribune.com/opinion. And you can also hear portions of this on my Wednesday afternoon show on WCCO.
I'm John Rash, columnist and editorial writer for the Star Tribune.
You understand that introduction, right, John? I mean, literally, sometimes walking out of the studio after we record the podcast, something has happened that I thought, oh, shoot, I wish we should have mentioned that. But you'll never record a podcast because so much is coming out of Washington and Minnesota, for that matter, so quickly these days.
Well, I'd even add to that, John, sometimes it's a sin of omission, but also commission, meaning we might talk about an issue on the Playing Politics podcast, and just within a matter of minutes, the trajectory of that issue in Washington, St. Paul, or elsewhere can change significantly as well. So you're right, we should not only date stamp it, but time stamp it as well. So.
Lori Sturtevant, your colleague in St. Paul, will be joining us, hopefully in this podcast, to talk about a couple of state issues, and we will get to them shortly. I want to talk about Jim Surdick. I want to talk about a pay raise for state lawmakers. But everybody today is talking about Rachel Maddow. Last night on MSNBC had Donald Trump's tax return for 2005, right? 2005
Correct.
Was the year. And in it, he paid millions in taxes. A lot of us were thinking, oh boy, here comes the smoking gun. I thought it was more smoke than fire. What did you think about it, John?
The same. And in fact, more than anything, perhaps it obscured the whole issue. She had an extraordinarily long setup and, you know, in effect did the opposite of the what's often called the inverted pyramid style of journalism, you know, where you go with the most important issue first. And instead of saying, in effect, we have 2 pages of 1 year of President Trump's tax returns, and they show this. She took about 20 minutes and a long commercial break as a big windup, giving all the potential reasons that have been much discussed for the last year and a half in terms of why presidential candidates and now President Trump himself should release his tax returns. And in the end, you know, it might indicate to some people that he had to write off a significant amount of losses, and perhaps the rate that he paid wasn't commensurate to, you know, what someone of his income or his wealth would pay. But that is hardly as significant an issue as those that she alluded to in the opening in terms of potential ties, in terms of business associates who might be inappropriate, or the bigger issue that is in front of Congress of the alleged Russian involvement in the 2016 campaign.
Yeah. And that stuff was intriguing. I mean, when she opened up with that and she was sort of building this web of this banker was on that board and that board members now in the cabinet and Donald Trump put money here, and the idea that some guy in Russia would give him millions and millions of dollars for a property, more than it was worth, and then tear it down, looked like a way just to sort of give money to Donald Trump. And so he thought, okay, where's this going? That story may have legs, but the connection from that to the tax return was lost in the commercial break to me. And I just to say one more thing here, John, I think you're absolutely right. I don't know much about print journalism, but I think you put the lead and then the most important facts first. Maybe it's that way in radio news, too. But if you're doing dramatic television, you save the good stuff for the end. The climax of drama comes at the end of the show. It's telling, isn't it, that that's how they played this out, not as news, but as drama. I think it did more to sort of reinforce the narrative that the media, Lord knows, MSNBC is out to get Donald Trump.
Absolutely, and that certainly is the line that the White House is taking and talking about the dishonest media and talking about the illegality of showing anyone's tax returns. And I think it's important to note right here that, you know, this was sent anonymously to David K. Johnson, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who writes about tax issues. He shared it with MSNBC. So as reporters, getting anonymous information and sharing it has nothing, there's nothing illegal about that act.
But nothing illegal, yeah.
Nothing illegal about that act. And there's but it did, as you say, shape the White House narrative about this is much more about the media and there's really nothing here.
Whereas because there was no crime. There was no she kept holding that thing up, and I thought, okay, it's going to say something. It didn't say that he broke the law. It said he paid $35 million in taxes.
Whereas if she would have just started off saying, this is what we know, now here are all the things we don't know and why it's very important that we continue to focus on getting this information from President Trump and from the White House, it would have been a very different dynamic. But she's facing, you know, a broad array of criticism from both journalistic
today,
as well as political circles as well. And again, it serves as a distraction from what most feel who are concerned about this issue is the real issue is he is the first candidate and now president in decades of both parties not to release his tax returns. And if not, why not? And that remains a question, but the question seems a bit obscured this morning.
Sure, but she did point that out. I mean, to her credit, she said, you know, whatever I'm about to show you, it must give you pause, is how she put it, that we don't know what the potential connections are with his policy or with his inner circle to Russia. If there's some quid pro quo that we don't know about on some, you know, international level, we should know about that. We don't. And so, you know, now everybody's criticizing her. And I will say this, John, I thought today a little bit about all the president's men and how when Woodward and Bernstein were first going down the Watergate trail, their paper took nothing but criticism and nobody knew that they had something. And lo and behold, they did, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm not ready to judge completely what she's got there. In fact, I think if you're MSNBC, you've already staked out the we criticize Donald Trump, you know, sort of turf. That's what you do. So you go ahead and keep doing that. You know, that wasn't CBS doing that. That wasn't CNN doing that. Ones that purportedly try and play it more down the middle. That was MSNBC, and we know how they work. But if they got the goods eventually, we'll all be better for it. But today, it's disappointing. To me, last night, it just looked like, you know, pretty good theater, but really just kind of the television they do all along. In fact, you know what, John? They didn't focus on the tax return itself much last night. I wanted to see a close shot of the numbers. I wouldn't understand them, but I would have been fascinated just to see the numbers last night.
And I think that shows the key difference on how, you know, a print newspaper like the Star Tribune or New York Times or Wall Street Journal or CBS Radio or CBS Television, as an example, might have had it. They would have led with, this is what we have, this is the limited information that we have, and this is what that limited information says. And then you can get to, here are all the unanswered questions. But I think on the broader issue, I concur that, you know, the real issue is what the president's tax returns say or don't say, and the reason why he has chosen not to release them so far. And the issue is not Rachel Maddow and MSNBC journalism practices.
Do you think that this thing was, we'll segue now to a couple of other topics, but do you think that was, because the administration, even though Donald Trump called it on Twitter today fake news, his administration has acknowledged that that's his return. And in fact, it's possible that they're the ones that released it, perhaps knowing this was going to happen in advance, but either way, they released it and acknowledged it. Is that maybe a distraction? Is this all some sort of grand scheme to keep us from overly analyzing the health care bill?
I don't know that, and I don't think anyone knows that. If indeed that were to be the case, it was successful in terms of blunting the issue. But yeah. I think it's very important, you know, for journalists to not speculate, you know, that that's the way that it happened. No one knows how David K. Johnston got this information here. So that being said, it was a diversion. We began the podcast, if you remember, John, by talking about how quickly the news changes. And here this big event or non-event in some eyes happened last night. And it comes in the context of a much broader dynamic that is going to impact so many more Americans. And that's the Republican efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And the bill that they came out in the Congressional Budget Office score of it, suggesting you know, that what would happen in terms of coverage and what would happen in terms of the overall federal deficit and those impacts and what kind of congressional future that this bill now has. And so that's really the when you get a little bit of a distance, the big story coming out of Washington right now. And it's an unfolding story because there certainly seems to be Republican resistance in the Senate. And so even if Speaker Ryan is able to wrestle this through the House, however, with slim a margin, you know, it's I think going to be really challenging to get it through the United States Senate.
Every time I ask an expert this question, I get a "well, it depends" answer. But I just want to know, what is it conceivable that this will be better? You know, that what the, you know, Paul Ryan facing all of this criticism from every sector, you know, from some conservatives, from certainly Democrats, from the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, AARP, everybody seems to be against it. He assures us that it's going to go through. And if it could conceivably be better, who wouldn't be for it? I wonder if that's possible, if more Americans will have more affordable insurance. If that's a possibility, I'm all for it. I wonder if that's possible. Does your newspaper take an editorial position on that per se?
Well, certainly it is possible. And certainly anytime you have a big political public debate like this, the reason, you know, the Republicans are moving this forward is they fundamentally believe that this will improve the situation. And so, you know, what they would argue and in many ways is that by making these changes, it's going to fundamentally change the insurance market and ultimately eventually make it more affordable to more Americans. Now, that being said, that's the very reason why we have institutions like the Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan organization, which, by the way, the head of it was appointed by the Republicans, you know, who control Congress at this point, who were able to give factual analysis to legislation to say, here's the impact short and long term for the United States of America. And so, yes, it is possible. And in terms of our editorial position, you know, we focused more than anything on what the CBO suggested would happen with this bill, and particularly the impact on older Americans who demographically might be the hardest hit if indeed this becomes law.
Real quickly, there continues to be no evidence that Barack Obama tapped Donald Trump's phones. That conversation has actually been brought successfully by Donald Trump into the conversation about whether or not the Russians hacked the U.S. election and how complicit his administration may have been. Very clever of them to do that. But we don't know anything more about that, except that still there's no evidence that Barack Obama did anything illegal, correct?
Not only no evidence, it's been very challenging, I think, for President Trump's colleagues in the White House, particularly Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway, who are charged with keeping this charge alive in the press, albeit with no evidence, and to the point where yesterday Mr. Spicer, during the White House press briefing, you know, used air quotes to describe wiretapping, which, you know, suggests the ultimate backing off of the charge, but seemingly not wanting to completely disassociate, you know, themselves from what President Trump is saying. And he doesn't seem to be backing off, and thus they're not able to, or so they professionally believe at this point. But, you know, in terms of what President Trump has called for, which is a congressional investigation, leaders in Congress who would be charged with this have basically said, come at us with evidence, give us more, and if it warrants an investigation, we'll do it. And they've put a timeline on that. They now have an extension to the timeline, but so far the White House hasn't offered anything that would make Congress move. And, you know, they might just move off of this issue as, you know, as we began with the podcast again, so many other dynamics are developing at this point that are going to grab the attention of Congress, the press, and the American people.
It's pretty remarkable at the White House press briefing on Monday when Pete Alexander, I think it was, from NBC, asked Sean Spicer if, in fact, we are to believe what the president says, or he was looking for a little guidance. And that's just an amazing question that the mainstream media needs to ask the president's spokesperson. Angela Merkel is having a meeting with Donald Trump. Is that what's going to happen?
Indeed, it was supposed to happen on Tuesday, but it was pushed back to Friday because of the impending winter storm, which might be appropriate given the chill that exists between Berlin and Washington at this point.
Oh, touche. Very nicely played there, John Rash.
Thank you. And I think really reflective of President Trump's election, but even more than that, you know, all the way back to December 2015 in a peek over not being named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, he tweeted out that instead they awarded it to Chancellor Merkel, the person who is, quote unquote, ruining Germany. And he's been critical of that. And I think even deeper than that, John, you know, by calling himself Mr. Brexit, he suggests that not only does he back the vote that is going to take the United Kingdom out of the European Union, but that, you know, suggesting that he thinks that the whole European project, as they call it over there, has run its course and is not advantageous. And of course, these are key allies, including Germany, France, and many other European nations who soundly believe that, you know, there's the reason the EU was created was after decades of, if not centuries of warfare, that although it's having its challenges, it needs to hold together here. So there's a real deep divide between President Trump's public statements and many leaders in Europe, and particularly because Chancellor Merkel is the continent's most consequential leader, I think it's going to, you know, be important that both of them have a successful summit. And then finally, it falls into the context of Chancellor Merkel is in a really tough re-election fight. Yeah. And unlike some of the countries, you know, the Netherlands is voting today and have a very strong populist surge. There's a big surge from the left wing in Germany, the Social Democrats, who have made a big public comeback. So that's going to be one of many key races that it's going to reflect and shape the future of Europe for years to come.
Let's talk about what's going on in St. Paul. Lori Sturtevant would normally join us. She's your go-to person on Capital News, but she's unable to join us for the podcast today. I must tell you, John, the story of Jim Surdick, of all things, deciding to open up Surdick's liquor stores on Sunday last weekend has exploded our phone lines. You guys have had hundreds and hundreds of comments on your webpage, and you editorialized about it, too. What is the Star Tribune's position on him opening up in advance of the sort of inaction of the law?
We were for Sunday sales. We are not for people flouting the law and opening up on Sunday before their competitors allow, and most important, before state law allows. So I think that this appropriately went through, and agonizingly for those who were for this position, it took years to get through the legislature. But you know, when a legislature passes a law and says that they're going to move forward with this, and this is when it can take effect, and it's not that it's years from now, it's just a few months from now, mm-hmm. and you have, you know, an individual owner who decides to flout that law, open up, and not only, you know, do something that is illegal, but also get an advantage over his competitors, that's not how...
Well, why on earth do you think he did it? Why did he do that? Was it to pick up one day's sales? Was it a promotional stunt? Did he not imagine what the consequences could be? Why did he do it, John? He hasn't taken our call. His attorney won't come on with us either.
It's a great question. And like you, John, I'm asking the same questions. Now, certainly, he got a tremendous amount of publicity. And there are those who will think that, you know, him jumping the gun here is exactly at times what this state needed, and to just move past this debate and share his position. There are others who will feel the same way, the Star Tribune, and indeed many commentators, you know, to our newspaper, many letter writers, and perhaps many of your callers as well, felt that, you know, regardless of how one feels about the law, it is the law, and doing this in such a brazen manner is not the way that Minnesota or any state or nation really can work. We're a nation
of laws.
Well, John,
do you think that the penalty fit the crime?
You know, my concern about the penalty is that the degree that it might hurt workers, you know, who work there, meaning if he doesn't, you know, employ some of them. But I think certainly a very strong message had to be sent. Otherwise, what you may have is, you know, if the penalty wasn't significant, or if the perception among other liquor store owners is, you know what, he just got a slap on the wrist, and why don't we do the same, you know, that just can't, this society and a civil structure just can't work that way. So, you know, how they could have structured the penalty, I'm not quite sure. I hope that Mr. Surdick, you know, as he goes about this and contemplates this, that he makes sure that it doesn't hurt his loyal workers, you know, who are the backbone to his business.
I'm imagining a John Sack cartoon, and here's, you can pass this on to him, he can draw it. It's probably too late, but here's my idea. There's a guy in a desert. He's crawled across the dunes to the beer stand in the desert, and his lips are parched, and he reaches up to get his beer from Jim Surdick, and there's the state legislature or somebody, city of Minneapolis, reaching in and saying, you got to wait until July 1st. It makes me wonder, if everybody's so damn thirsty for beer on Sundays, why did we wait until the July 4th weekend to allow them to sell it. If everybody's on board, let's go. Why the delay?
Well, first, you'll be glad to know that Steve Sack is a regular listener to this podcast, often comments on it.
Sorry, Steve. And I got his name wrong, too. So thank you. Sorry, Steve.
He'll be glad to hear this, and he'll be glad, you know, I think, for the idea here. And it's a great question. You know, that this is something that has been debated for years, John. And I would argue that no matter which side of the debate that an individual was on, the amount of energy that it took up in the state capitol relative to other problems in the state was highly inefficient and inappropriate in terms of our legislative energy and the bandwidth that people in St. Paul have in a relatively limited legislative session. But let me take it a step further here. So on this issue, I think the next liquor-related legal issue that is going to come up at the legislature, certainly I don't think this year, but in subsequent years, is whether grocery stores can sell wine or even beyond that, as they can in so many other states in the union. Now, let's say that in the 2018 session, they finally cross that off their list and one can go into their local grocery store and buy liquor. And that would probably have a very similar time frame in terms of when that's allowed. Well, if one grocery store chain said, you know what, this is legal now, the governor has signed it, I'm just going to jump the gun, we'd have the same kind of chaos. And so that's why a message had to be sent. And I certainly don't think you're going to see any other individual liquor store owner repeat what Jim Cerdak did up in Northeast Minneapolis.
45% pay raise for state lawmakers, said a independently appointed commission. And that would be just a little bit less than what inflation would have given them if they had been getting annual pay increases. So what do you all think at the Star Tribune about them going from about $30,000 to about $45,000 a year?
Our editorial position has long been that it's important to pay enough that we attract quality candidates for the state legislature. And I think it's really important that some of the men and women who are willing to serve, and they serve very long hours and do it with great honor and a tremendous amount of hard work.
Agreed.
As you mentioned, you know, they have not, you know, they have not even kept pace with inflation here, and it's not a way for anyone to get rich. They do it truly because of public service. And when they come in and talk to us in the editorial board, whether we agree with their position or not, or endorse their candidacy or not, we don't question their motives in terms of that they want to serve the state. And it's very important that we have quality people who do that. So for that very reason was the idea that they, you know, asked the voters about this commission that they put together to try to rectify this. Because what happens is, you know, that when legislators are asked to vote on their own pay, you'll have enough who will vote against it. And then nearly every candidate who, you know, might choose a primary or general election will run against those who voted for it and criticize them for raising their own pay. You'll never raise the pay and you don't get the quality of candidate accordingly. So, you know, I think that was the right process.
Is there some pushback on this though, John?
There is, and Speaker Dowd has spoken about it in terms of if there's any kind of legislative way that they might be able to blunt some of this raise, you know, that might be coming forward. I don't know if that truly has legs or, you know, how much what the prospect is for that. But I think that, you know, for that very reason, the fact that it might be back in the political process is why they finally tried to break this logjam and try to bring some rationality, you know, to this issue. So, you know, given the short time frame remaining in the legislative session, an extraordinary amount of work and bills that they need to pass. And if you remember back to last legislative session and then all the talk of the special session that never really happened, you know, there's a whole lot that needs to be done with transportation and and taxes and other issues, that this would seem to be not the best use of, as I mentioned before, that legislative bandwidth.
Any last observations from you, John, before we wrap up this week's Playing Politics?
That you began it quite well, talking about the incredible speed and pace of news. And, you know, you and I, John, have been doing this for quite some time, and this is about as extraordinary a news period as most can remember for such a duration, you know, from the campaign on. So, you know, there are going to be real key issues. I think the big thing to watch is something we began the conversation with, is that Speaker Ryan has a very aggressive timetable on moving the repeal and replace bill in the House right now, moving that forward. So I think when we're talking next week on Playing Politics, that's going to be yet again a key issue to revisit.
Nice to talk to you, John Rash. John with the Star Tribune, of course. You can also hear him with Dave Lee on WCCO Radio in the mornings. And you can hear this podcast if you're not listening to it right now at startribune.com/opinion. You can check it out on our Facebook page, WCCO Radio's Facebook page. And portions of this are broadcast on our Wednesday afternoon show, about 3:30 on WCCO.